May it please the court. Oh, my name is Jeff Walsh. I am counsel for the appellant, Larry Flippo. My registration number is 33762, and I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
There are two issues in this case. One, whether the trial court erred in allowing the district attorney here to cross-examine Mr. Flippo's therapist about his treatment for a prior alleged sexual impropriety. Two, whether or not the trial court erred in designating Mr. Flippo a sexually violent predator. Now, in my argument this morning, I'm actually going to address those issues in reverse order. So I'll deal with the sexually violent predator issue first and then move on to the evidentiary issue. In the state of Colorado, a sex offender can be designated as a sexually violent predator if they satisfy four criteria. And those criteria are well outlined in the briefs. And only one of those criteria are relevant to this appeal. And it is whether Mr. Flippo promoted his relationship with the victim here with the intent to sexually victimize her. And this begs the question, obviously, of what does it mean to promote in this context? And this court, the Court of Appeals, has decided that in People versus Tixier, which is addressed in the briefs. And the court essentially held that one promotes a relationship in this context when he seeks to enlarge the scope of the relationship with the intent to sexually victimize. And so that begs the question in this case of whether or not Mr. Flippo, when he sought to enlarge the scope of his relationship with the victim from his limited relationship with just a phone relationship, they'd only been talking on the phone for a month, to meeting in person by inviting her up to his home in Greeley. The question is, when he invited her up to his home in Greeley to meet in person, was his intent to rape her?
And doesn't it also beg the question of how much difference we give the trial court, which was the fact finder on that point?
It's a mixed question of law, in fact. So any finding of fact that the court makes is subject to a clearly erroneous standard of review, but the actual trial court's holding of law or his application of the facts of the law is a de novo review. And so the actual finding about what his intent was, because it's one of those four criteria, is a finding of law that's subject to de novo review. The facts that he relies on, the factual findings that he made to say, based on these facts, I'm finding that the intent is present, those factual findings are subject to highly deferential review. But the actual finding of intent is a legal determination of those four criteria. And so that leads me to the question is, what's Mr. Flippo's intent when he invites the victim up to Greeley? And the court found his intent was to rape. And in this sense, the court erred in three substantial ways. And I'm going to list them, the three ways, real quickly, and then I'll come back and address each in turn. And the first way is that the court relied on a finding of fact that was clearly erroneous. The second way was that the court predominantly relied on facts that were the facts of the sexual assault itself, which as a matter of law is not permissible. The third error that the court made was the court made a finding that Mr. Flippo's intent in inviting the victim up to Greeley was for sexual gratification. Now, we don't contest that. The record establishes that in abundance. What the court then did, though, was basically to equate sexual gratification with sexual victimization. The court implicitly held, because his intent was for sexual gratification, he therefore had an intent for sexual victimization, set up a construct that really is just not logically defensible. So to go back to my first point, the court's finding here is actually contained in about 8 lines of transcript. And that it's very brief, and I'd like to look at that. It's on page 22 of my opening brief where I've excerpted those lines of the transcript. And so in the event you want to follow along with me, it's at page 22, because there's a couple things that the judge said which are really critical to highlight my point. And the judge says, and I'm quoting here, I'm required to consider the circumstances surrounding the crime that Mr. Flippo was convicted of. And I'm convinced that under the Colorado's sexually violent predator screening instrument, that the defendant, in fact, established, and then he corrects himself and he says, promoted, that the defendant promoted a relationship primarily for the purpose of sexual victimization. And then he goes on to talk about what evidence he's relying on. These are the findings of fact that he would rely on to make that determination. And now I'm quoting again. He says, first of all, he says, I am required to make a finding as to whether or not the purpose was sexual victimization. And he says, that is what he talked about when he talked to the victim on the phone. Now that modifies, it's referring to victimization. The court is making a factual finding that victimization is what the defendant talked to the victim about on the phone. That is just clearly erroneous. No, there's not a scintilla of evidence in this record that their phone conversations, which constituted pretty graphic phone sex by the admission of the victim, there was never sexual victimization, violence, anything discussed in their phone conversation. Yet the trial court here is making a finding that victimization is what they talked about on the phone. It's just not there. It's a clearly erroneous factual finding. This actually goes to my third point, which is what I think the trial judge was doing was conflating and actually in equating sexual gratification with sexual victimization, which would explain why the court would say that. The court then
isn't the court in effect saying that he was bound to have sex with her whether or not she consented? Isn't that the bottom line of what the court's saying, that he was planning, that was the promotion end of it?
Was he going to
have sex? If it was consensual, fine, but if not, it would be a victimization situation because he was bent on having sex with her.
I don't believe that that's what the court is saying here. Is that what your question mm-hmm. is? No, I don't think that any fair reading of what the court is saying here is that the court is saying, hey, he was going to have sex with her no matter what. If she consented, great, and if she didn't, too bad. I don't believe that that would be a fair reading of what this text is saying. So to move on to my first point is, we've got a clearly erroneous finding. They aren't talking about victimization on the phone. We're talking about sex. And
this is true of the last phone call as well, the one after this had all happened?
Well, that wouldn't even be germane to the analysis because the question, what we have to have, we need a concurrency of intent with the time at which he invites her up to Greeley. So the conversation that he has with her that's tape recorded after the fact is after the assaults occurred. So whatever he said there, I would submit it is actually not germane to the question of whether or not his intent was, unless he said something on, if he said on the phone, yeah, I was going to rape you no matter what, then yeah, that would be relevant, but that's not what he said.
Okay.
So I actually think that the substance of that call just isn't germane to this question.
Okay.
So from here, the court then goes on to say, after he says, well, when she, the victim, arrives in Greeley, he, the defendant, acted totally in a manner that convinces the court that he wasn't nurturing this relationship as the love of his life or his new girlfriend that he was going to marry. His actions betray that argument. His actions, in the court's opinion, I'm going to find, clearly demonstrated that he promoted this relationship primarily for the purpose of sexual gratification and for the sexual victimization of the victim. What he's doing and the facts that he's relying on here, he's talking about the sexual assault itself. And this court, subsequent to my filing the opening brief in this case, I filed a notice of supplemental authority that I filed last week in People versus Valencia in 2011. This court held, and I'm quoting, to promote a relationship primarily for the purpose of sexual victimization, an offender must engage in some conduct beyond the sexual assault itself, which is designed to expand an existing relationship into one primarily for the purpose of sexual victimization.
But in the Valencia case, the defendant and the victim were in a consensual sexual relationship 2 weeks before the assault. Isn't that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the problem in that case was that the trial court designated him a sexual violent predator because of the egregious nature of the assault. I mean, Mr. Valencia had hid in the closet, lay in wait, come out, stabbed her in the throat, raped her. I mean, it was just horrific. And the court said he's a sexually violent predator. And the trial court and the court of appeals said, no. You can't use the facts of the sexual assault itself to make this finding because you need a concurrency of intent with when he sought to expand. And so the point is that here the trial court used the evidence of the sexual assault itself, the facts of the sexual assault itself, to say, I find his intent was to victimize. And my point is, hey, and the Attorney General does the same thing in his answer brief. is he uses, you know, he says, well, you know, he was grabbing her when she didn't want to be grabbed, and he lifted her skirt when she didn't want her skirt lifted, and he took her shoes off when she didn't want her shoes taken off. And that's all part and parcel of the sex assault itself. It's not indicative of what Mr. Filippo's intent was when he said, hey, would you come up and stay with me in Greeley for a week?
But the sexual assault itself happens later in the evening. The lifting the skirt, the touching of the breast, so forth, happens much earlier in the evening, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I would submit that it's part of the res gestae of the whole event, and that it is part of the sex assault, number one. And number two, even if you can separate those and say, you know, the sex assault happened at midnight and the lifting of the skirt, et cetera, happened at 10 or 9 or whatever. You know, those acts do not indicate what his intent was a week earlier when he was on the phone with her and said, will you come up and visit me in Greeley?
Can I ask you, because you're running out of time, can I ask you to address the 404B issue, please?
Sure. Specifically, whether or not it was preserved or whether or not it in fact was error.
Whether it was in fact error.
Okay. So, yes, it was error because it created the inference. So the question, it basically is implied to the jury that he had been treated for sexual impropriety in the past. And that's either, you can either look at it as a character trait, which is impermissible under 404A, or you can look at it as a prior bad act, which is impermissible under 404B.
Excuse me, Mr. Walsh, you wanted to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. I just want to let you know you have about 3 minutes and 40 seconds left.
Yeah, so I'm going to, I appreciate the reminder. I'll be watchful.
Okay.
And so part of my reason I wanted to say rebuttal was to address this issue. So we're kind of getting to the point. The point is that they were basically told, hey, look, he's been treated for some kind of prior sexual impropriety. And there was no limiting instruction. The defense had never been given notice of this, never been given a hearing about whether there was a preponderance of evidence as to whether or not that actually happened, which the record would suggest it didn't. There was never any precise evidentiary hypothesis under Spoto and Garner that was articulated as to why it's admissible. There was no limiting instruction given as to how the jury could or could not consider it. I mean, basically the jury was left unfettered access to say, gosh, this guy had been treated previously for some kind of sexual impropriety, and now he's on trial for rape.
But Mr. Walsh, was there any testimony that there was any prior sexual impropriety?
There wasn't direct testimony of that fact, Your Honor. There was the very strong implication of such. The district attorney asked a leading question, which clearly suggested, you know, a leading question by definition has the answer contained in the question. And the district attorney has this pattern of asking questions, which he knows the answer to. And he knows the record better than the witness. And he says he's been treated for sexual impropriety, has he not? And the doctor says, she gives an uncertain answer and says, well, I'm not aware of him ever being treated for that with me. But just on the prior page in the transcript, they've established by implication that he's been seeing several types of doctors.
But is that prior bad act evidence, or is that simply given the answer, which is a neutral one? There is no evidence in the record and wasn't pursued further.
Well, I think her answer actually created the implication. I think if you combine the leading question with the uncertainty of her answer, which is, I'm not aware of him receiving any of that kind of treatment with me, and then the DA then later saying, oh, well, I guess you weren't involved with that, it creates the distinct impression to the jury that there's a there. So I mean, I get the point. I mean,
is it evidence or is it just an implication?
It's an implication, and I think it's a strong implication. And I think that it's not harmless error, because the entire defense here was that Mr. Filippo, due to his developmental disability, that he didn't understand she didn't consent. And if the jury is told, or strongly implied to, that he's been treated before, been in therapy for sexual boundaries and what was in some kind of sexual impropriety in the past, that would just blow out of the water his claim that because of his developmental disability, he didn't know she didn't consent. So that, you know, it's the impermissible inference under 404B, and it's not harmless. It is harmful. It blew the whole defense out of the water. I'll reserve my remainder.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh. You have 40 seconds left for your rebuttal.
Good I'm not that coordinated. I can't do that, so. May it please the court, I'm Matthew Holman, and I represent the people in this matter. I think on both of these issues, the defendant is parsing them too finely and carving out little bits of them to make his arguments. And that's troubling for two reasons. One is that's what my job usually is. and the other is that I just don't think it works here. I think that that when you look at the record as a whole, it supports the trial court's rulings on both of these issues. I will talk briefly about the sexually violent predator issue first, which is where my opponent started, and then I'll talk about the cross-examination issue also. So the sexually violent predator finding the court, I just want to start with this. My understanding of what my opponent is saying is he essentially wants to treat this finding that the primary purpose was to promote sexual victimization as almost a criminal mens rea situation where there must be an intent and there must be a concurrence of an act in order for the court to find it, and without that it doesn't stand up. And I don't think that's the way that this operates. I think it's a much more of a sort of a factual overall broad determination by the court. I think the evidence here supports the charges for, and I think what the trial court was saying is, first, I don't find the defendant's argument credible that his purpose was to promote marriage and a love relationship. What I find, based on his actions throughout, from the phone calls to the point of sexual assault that evening, to be promoting primarily his sexual gratification and sexual victimization. And I think those facts, as set forth in the record, support that finding, which is...
Is that a factual determination, or was that, as suggested by counsel, an issue of law that we reviewed de novo?
I think I would agree that it's probably a combination of factual determination, and then ultimately, I think almost all issues, honestly, are some combination of factual issues and law. But the factual finding is what's driving the court's decision here, and I think ultimately is correct.
Well, where does the intent go? I mean, the bottom line is, and your counterpart said that the intent's a legal issue. Do you agree with that?
I don't think it's intent. I think the statute says what's the primary purpose. I'm parsing the terms here, but I think that's different from saying an intent like a mens rea intent. I think what the court looks at is what was the purpose of promoting the relationship here, and that was for sexual victimization. And I'll talk briefly about that, and then I would like to talk about the Valencia case too, but I think the acts here amply support the trial court's ruling. I mean, from the, you know, beginning with the phone calls, that there's some sexual engagement there, and then when she arrives immediately, she's going up the stairs and he's grabbing her buttocks. This proceeds to other grabbing and groping and putting his head under her skirt when his friends are there. His friends are shocked by his behavior. They leave. He continues in this behavior despite her statements. I can't, sort of underlying this is this implication that somehow this is not sexual victimization until she's sexually assaulted. I think it begins at that moment where the woman he hardly knows comes in, tells him nothing's going to happen, and violates her privacy and her personal space by touching her and looking at her in this fashion. I think she's being victimized at the beginning. The idea that this is somehow some just sort of gratification as a nice term and victimization is something else is just not supported.
Mr. Holman, what is your response to Mr. Walsh's first point that the trial court's findings were clearly erroneous because the trial court referred to the concept of victimization during a telephone call?
One moment, Your Honor. I'm grabbing the language from the court. I don't think that's correct. I think what the court is saying here is, let's see, I'm convinced that that in fact it promoted a relationship primarily for the purpose of sexual victimization. That is what he talked about when he talked to the victim on the phone. When she arrived here in Greeley, he acted totally in a manner that convinces the court that he wasn't nurturing this relationship as the love of his life or his new girlfriend that he was going to marry. His actions betray that argument. And I think the court's looking at the overall behavior from the start with the phone call.
But was there anything at all during the month of phone calls that indicated that there was, that the defendant's purpose was to promote a sexual relationship or promote victimization?
I think there was evidence that he was interested in promoting a sexual relationship. I think
right, that, but that doesn't make a person a sexually violent predator.
Well, I would say that in isolation is true, and again, this goes back to my first point of parsing the facts and the analysis here, which is, I think the court is, as we do in the context of a criminal determination, we look at behavior as a whole. I would say, as I think Judge Roman was asking about, is even when you get to the last phone call, in our overall view of the defendant's behavior, is there something that shows that he's primarily for sexual victimization? I think it's not parsed out into that moment. I think, I don't think that's what the court was saying, was I find sexual victimization standing alone as to the phone conversations at the beginning of the relationship. I think the court's saying, when I look at all of these things together, all the way up to the sexual assault, I can't find that this was primarily for love and marriage. This was for the purposes of sexual victimization. I think that's the court's point there. I wanted to talk briefly about the Valencia case, which I think actually supports the trial court's ruling here. Again, I don't read it to say there must be necessarily evidence independent of the sexual assault itself to find that that's the primary purpose is sexual victimization. I think the facts there are quite distinguishable, and I think the court makes a nice legal point that actually supports our court's finding here. Now, in that case, as the court knows, the defendant's ex-boyfriend sneaks into her house and hides in her closet, and when she comes home that night, he bursts out brutally and violently attacks her. She becomes unconscious at some point. When she awakens, he forces her to engage in sex with him. Now, none of that fits into the type of facts we have here, where there is some effort at some type of ongoing relationship, and that's involving the sexual victimization development. It's almost like stranger assault in that, under those facts. And when the court is saying that there isn't evidence to support finding that primary purpose of sexual victimization, the Valencia court says, quote, there was no evidence that the defendant introduced inappropriate sexual contact during the relationship. And so that's very distinctive from what we have here, where the defendant repeatedly is introducing inappropriate sexual contact during the relationship. From the time she arrives at his apartment until the sexual assault and ultimately to her escape from the apartment or leaving the apartment. So I think that case is easily distinguished legally and factually from this one. And I don't think that case in any way undermines or is contrary to the trial court's ruling here. I will now turn, unless there are questions about sexually violent predator issue, I'll turn briefly again to the cross-examination issue. And the 404B, which I will touch on. I guess I would just like to hit a couple of highlights about the cross-examination in general, which is Rule 611B, I think it's the Salas case, indicate that cross-examination is broad and can cover any matters that are related to what was covered on direct examination. And here, the expert opines that the defendant suffers from frontal lobe disorder and developmental disability, and she also opines that he may have falsely confessed. And she bases this on 2 years of treatment that includes individualized therapy, an anger management group, and a relationship group. And the relationship group includes sex education about appropriate boundaries, basic good manners, some legal issues, and self-esteem. Given that this is the basis for her opinion, anything that goes to the treatment and her knowledge of the defendant is essentially fair game on cross-examination, because those things that she's informed about form the basis for the opinion.
But the question about sexual impropriety, once it comes in that way, doesn't that have potential 404B implications? I mean, it's impropriety they're talking about.
Well, two things. Well, okay, maybe more than two things. But one of them is I don't think the term sexual impropriety is particularly charged for several reasons. One is, on its face, it just means sexual inappropriateness. And just to clarify, the question is this. Sexual impropriety, and the witness says something to the effect of, I don't recall any sexual impropriety for which I was treating him.
But prior to that, the question was, and so he'd been receiving treatment for impulse control issues, correct? Yes. He had been receiving issues with poor judgment, yes? Sexual impropriety? I mean, there's clearly an implication there.
And her answer is no. I think, in essence, her answer is no, I was not treating for that. And she goes on to say, which I think further buttresses the fact that she's saying she didn't know of any, is that the treatment he was getting was the standard treatment that everybody was getting in that program, which was preventative in nature. And so I think I don't think her answer implies in any manner that he, in fact, had engaged in any sexual impropriety. And I guess, stepping back one step, let's assume that the answer would have been yes, that is what he's being treated for. Then that would be fair game, because again, we are now examining her expert opinion that he falsely confessed to the crime here. And as we know with experts, not only do we get to ask them things that they know, and again, her scope is, I treated him, and that's how I know this about him, that if she knew this, that's fair game. We get to ask experts, what if you knew this other fact? If you'd known that he engaged in a sexual assault, would that change your opinion? That's always fair game. So that's one thing. I think if the answer had been yes, it was a proper question. I think we get the opposite answer from the expert here. And again, if the defendant had thought that this was somehow misleading, defense counsel could have got up on recross and could have asked the question. So you know about sexual impropriety here. If they thought this was a misleading statement, I don't think it was. I think the answer was there, not that I know of, and he was just in the standard course. And again, I just don't find the term sexual impropriety exceptionally charged, especially in the context of her treatment, which was saying these people are learning about boundaries. Sexual impropriety, I presume, would be crossing a boundary line in that context. I just don't read it as so, even if it implies something that it was so highly prejudicial, that it would require any reversal here. And I think the testimony is really just cumulative of things that were already discussed on direct and in other unobjected to cross-examination. So if there were error, it would be harmless. Unless there are other questions, I would thank the court for its time. I've always wanted to use the term nunk-pro-tunk, so I ask that this argument be nunk-pro-tunk to 9 a.m. this morning.
Your request is granted, Mr. Holman. Mr.
Can we go back in time?
There's one point I want to make, which is that this court, in order to reverse on the sexually violent predator issue, does not need to find that believe that Mr. Flippo was actually in love with the victim here or intended to marry her as he professed when he invited her to Greeley. All that you need to find is that his intent was something other than raping her when he invited her to Greeley. And I would posit the following. It's very conceivable that his intent was to have consensual sex with her when he invited her up. They had a phone sex relationship. He cooked this elaborate dinner for her before her arrival, invited all of his friends over to meet her. He bought her lingerie. All that would suggest that his intent was consensual sex. And then when she said no, things changed.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh. Thank you both for your arguments this morning. We appreciate your arguments, and we appreciate your coming back in light of our power outage. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. That concludes.